I'm Ken Hemmings, and he is Chris Lang, and welcome to another of these regular property briefings. Again, a warm welcome to you, Chris.
Well, it's glad to be with you again, Ken.
What I'd like to do today is return to some of the underlying principles that drive commercial property. So, where should we start?
Well, as you can appreciate, commercial property has a complex set of factors that influence it. I mean, it has some unique financing requirements. You've got various property management options you can look at. And, of course, leasing is quite different from residential property. And getting a full grasp of these factors, and that's partly why I provide so much information on my websites, is to just help people come to if not a complete understanding, at least a basic understanding of all the components that you need to understand to make a sensible choice when it comes to commercial property investment. And just to differentiate the difference between office, retail and industrial, because while it's different to residential, it's not overly complicated. It's just having to approach things with a different mindset. And I mean, the fundamental drivers for commercial property growth are similar to the residential market in that it's demand. But demand for residential property is very fickle. It's very much affected by interest rates and just general confidence. Whereas commercial demand is driven more by economic factors. You've got your population growth, obviously, but as the economy improves, your larger companies start to grow and have demand for more materials, and therefore that starts to impact on commercial property. And we certainly saw this with the mining boom, and that's dissipated, and now trying to make the transition into the service-based economy. And the mining companies, while they're not expending as much money in development and buying expensive machinery, are now working the mines and actually producing more than they were during boom times. And so it's turned to an export market rather than a construction and development-driven market. And so it's certainly Australia is experiencing a slowdown. And I suppose fortunately or unfortunately, depending which way you look at it, the demand is being augmented from overseas with our falling dollar. Even though prices might be going up for commercial property relative to what they were a week or a month earlier for overseas buyers, they're actually cheaper because of the differential in the dollar. So the local market, to a degree, is being put under a fair amount of pressure. And the more so residentially, a lot of Asian money is going to residential property because that's what they understand, but the big money is going into the commercial market, mainly in the CBDs, which is then having a flow-on effect in prices and availability of decent investments out into the suburban market. So, as I said, it's a complex market and you do need some guidance, but you also need to have a basic understanding of what's going on so that at least you can ask the right questions.
Okay, you've just covered the general backdrop. Perhaps you might explore some particular aspects.
Well, a couple of specific factors would be infrastructure development. Now, the Reserve Bank uses interest rates to manage inflation. In some respects, it's a clumsy tool because there tends to be a delayed effect. But with inflation falling and economic activity being soft, they've reduced interest rates because they could afford to. And as they reduce interest rates, that generally will lower the dollar relative to overseas markets. Now, the aim of the Reserve Bank there is to increase demand for our export products and therefore increase activity. Unfortunately, Australia's interest rate has always remained much higher than other countries. I mean, even though we're at a sort of record lows of 2%, other countries are almost at zero. Now, the US have talked for a long time of increasing their interest rates, and that seems to be underway. And that will have an effect also of lowering our dollar a little further. But as activity picks up, the Reserve Bank will increase interest rates, and people get sort of nervous and upset about that. But what it means is, and even in America, the reason they're wanting to increase their interest rates now is because inflation is starting to creep up and they need to keep some control over it. Now, fortunately, in Australia, inflation is not an issue. But when interest rates increase, that's good news, not bad news, because it means that the economy is starting to pick up pace and accelerate and therefore cause increases in inflation. So an increase in interest rates is actually a good sign, not a bad sign. Now, while it might cost you more to borrow money as a commercial property investor, what it means is that there is activity that's going to underpin the future growth of your property. So as interest rates start to increase, you're probably better to lock in your interest rate. So that's fixed. So as growth improves, you don't have an increasing interest bill along the way. So then you look at infrastructure development, which governments like to, in times of slower economic activity, spend more on. Now, unfortunately, there's been so much bickering at the federal level that there hasn't been that much infrastructure developments. I mean, I think in the western outskirts of Sydney, the opening of the M7 bypass, now that led to an increased demand for warehouse property in the outer areas, and cheap land and access to good roads provides the impetus needed for transport companies to relocate their warehousing facilities. And the same thing happened a number of years ago when the Western Ring Road in Melbourne opened up. There were whole areas that people just had no access to and there was obviously no demand for. But as soon as the Ring Road was completed, those areas became very, very attractive because of easy access around. So infrastructure does have an impact quite apart from the funds spent and the wages earned and the people employed in building the infrastructure. It's what it opens up and the flow-on effect that follows on from that. And that has, you know, a considerable impact on the commercial property market and its growth.
Tell me, what part does population play?
Well, population and its impact probably falls under three categories. Demographics, and that's the understanding of groupings of people and where they move to as different opportunities migrate or open up, and therefore they migrate to those. Now, I mean, with the baby boomers, they're having this sort of sea change move. Now, what that's meant is in those areas where they've gone to, there has to be a sudden demand which has to be met by healthcare services and other retirement area facilities and things like that. When you have new suburbs opening up, obviously childcare facilities have to be met. So as people move, or groups of people move to different places, and I mean down in Geelong where I live now, because of the huge population explosion in Geelong, because young couples are finding it, you know, for half to two-thirds the price they can get a house that is considerably larger than what they can get in Melbourne. And yet, if they want to hop on a train and go to Melbourne, it's only an hour away. And I mean, to get from Doncaster, which is a traditional suburb to Melbourne, it actually takes you longer by car or even train sometimes to get from there to the CBD. So people are actually moving down, even if they are commuting back to their jobs, but more often than not, the jobs will then open up in the areas where they've moved to. And I mean, in Geelong now, I think there's Epworth Hospital is spending $277 million building a new hospital as part of the Warren Ponds campus of Deakin University. And that will then underpin a medical faculty that's being opened up there. So infrastructure, again, we're talking about, but a lot of it's caused by demographics. And so as things change, it creates the opportunities for smaller strata offices to be built and occupied by people who are then serving those that have moved as a group to a new area. So then you've got population growth and, you know, new suburbs spring up and provide opportunities for specific retail. And I mean, retail for me is still not my favoured sector to be investing in. However, when you have a new suburb where you have a large young population, you start to see the things like pizza shops and chicken shops and so forth, quite apart from the McDonald's and Kentucky Fried, but the more healthy lines open up there. And if they're close to an estate, they almost have a captive audience. It might be just a group of small shops, you know, five or six shops there, but because of where they are, you know, the young mums driving home today are quite happy to pick up a charcoal grilled chicken on the way home rather than sit down, because they're working mums that pick the kids up from school and they really don't want to set about cooking. So sometimes retail, which is protected and underpinned by a surge of population growth in an area, can be very well provide a very good investment going forward. And that sort of then ties into retail spending, because consumer spending increases, and it, as soon as that increases, that places a demand on warehousing, because we don't have a lot of manufacturing in Australia. It's mainly warehousing and logistics that occupy the industrial space. And most of that is storage applied to retailers. So as retail activity picks up, so does the demand and the growth in rents and value of industrial property as well. So while the sectors are separate, they are in fact interrelated.
So far, everything you've mentioned relates to external issues. Perhaps you might talk about some of the property-specific aspects which could affect your decisions.
Well, when you're looking at a property, obviously, ongoing rent is important. I mean, both for you and the financier in advancing the funds to you. So you need to look at the length of the lease. Now, unlike residential property, which is 6 to 12 month leases, commercial properties are generally 3, 5, sometimes longer. Now, yes, it might take a little bit longer to find a tenant, but the turnover is much lower. Plus, of course, as you know, the commercial tenants, the leases are generally structured so that they pay the outgoing, so that you end up not only with a net figure being paid, but that net figure is quite often 2 or 2.5 times the net rent that you would receive from a residential property. So having a good lease in place is important, and that's something that will drive the value of a property going forward. Obviously, the size of the property is important. You know, depending on whether you're just stepping into the commercial market or you've been a longer-term investor, it'll make a difference between the size of the property that you will buy. Initially, you may start out and buy, you know, a small property. It might be, you know, 100 square metres. It might be a bit more, because you're in the sort of 400,000 to 800,000 price bracket. Now, you know, it doesn't matter, but as you get to the point in your portfolio when you can step out and buy a larger property, you should. But then what you keep in mind is, in buying the larger property, could it, during the time of the existing tenant, be legally subdivided into two or more titles? Or if and when the tenant were to leave, could it be easily subdivided so that even though you have a larger amount of money invested in a larger property, you're able to carve it up into smaller bite-sized pieces? Now, you can still lease the property to one tenant. You might have three separate leases. So at any point, you could sell off one or more of the parts, or if you were to sell the whole lot, it meant that then the next buyer has the comfort of knowing that if they get caught, they could sell off one or more of the bits. So size is important, and that drives it, because as soon as you can buy a larger property, which is effectively like buying wholesale, and break it up into smaller pieces, that means it's sort of like that's the retail version of the property. It means that your selling yield will fall because more people can buy the smaller pieces than the larger pieces, therefore the demand's greater, therefore they pay you a higher price. So overall, that will improve and add value to the property. So size is important. Supply and demand is something too. You know, if the area, and this is where you've got to look around when you purchase and see whether in the area it would be easy for someone down the track to replicate the building in which you have whole or part ownership of the property. So if it's easy for someone to create more space, that's a potential risk going forward, because that means that in 3-5 years' time, if a new building comes online, tenants may gravitate to that new building. So that's why it's important to understand that location is important, but if you have purchased in a building that is well-designed, good amenities, is timeless, for want of a better word. In other words, it's not a trendy facade or entry foyer. And so that over time, even if there is new property coming on the market, it could be quickly, the common areas could be quickly tricked up to bring it into, you know, current day appeal. And so that you just need to understand that the competition down the track is not necessarily bad, because just because of the sheer cost of building, the rents they will need to ask will be much higher. And it may well mean that you have the opportunity to pitch your rent at, say, 2/3 or 80% of the new rent. So a tenant looks at it and says, well, yeah, I'd love the new building, but you know, I'm comfortable here, there's costs of moving, I can get a rent at a cheaper rate, so I'm happy, I'm going to stay. And so there are some of the things you need to take into account.
Is there anything else you feel needs discussing?
Well, just to quickly round out the discussion, obviously the investment structure, the vehicle that you're going to purchase it in, is it going to be individually, as a company, a syndicate? You're going to have a unit trust. And this is why with my clients, I tend to spend the first 10 minutes with the lawyers talking to their tax partner and have the client map out where they want to go, what do they want to achieve over the next 10, 15, 20 years, and therefore decide there and then at the outset what would be the best vehicle. So, I mean, that's a whole nother discussion. Finance, obviously, make sure you've got a good broker, because they can quickly source finance. And we had one recently where the finance was sourced from something that I wouldn't have really figured, but they wanted to balance their loan book, and there was a special deal available. I think it was only for a 28-day period, but it was about 0.5 percentage point difference, or it might have been. Yeah, I think it was 0.5 percentage point difference. So, I mean, you and I wouldn't know where those deals or when those deals are available, but a competent finance broker would and can steer you in the right direction. And then property management, again, that can make or break a deal. You need a good property manager who treats it, your property as though it's his or hers, is proactive, coming to you with ideas, identifying issues that could potentially arise so you can address them early and cheaply, and generally make sure your tenant performs to the maximum, but keeping a good relationship at the same time so that it builds value for you going forward.
I realise we may have touched on some of these aspects before, but not in this context. And it's always helpful to provide a recap every now and then.
Well, as with everything, Ken, it's only by regular repetition that we can actually learn and succeed.
You're absolutely right. And anyway, I look forward to seeing you next week.